to this question of like what it would be like to be multiple, how we would experience it, and how wide is the spectrum, as in between Sybil or, you know, the sort of cliche of a split person, multiple personality, where they actually, you know, change their voice and they become different ages and all that kind of stuff. And what I would say is probably so common as even to be almost universal, which is that we, I guess, I mean, like bringing it back to what you're saying at the beginning about emotions, or what I was saying, how emotions aren't emotions a part of us. So this is a very profound question itself. The moods, like to what extent do different moods correspond with identities? And how, you know, how easy and quickly we can shift from one mood to the other, like some trigger. You know, 1 minute we're peaceful, content. Next minute we're brimming with rage or suicidal despair, speaking personally here. And the smallest trigger can be the smallest thing. Like, isn't that like identity, different identities?
That's a tough question for me. I mean, it would make sense that it could be part of that. If you were switching from those types of emotions so quickly, there has to be something there, would there not be?
Well, it's obviously a trigger. As I said that already, if we're getting triggered, then that's something in the past that corresponds with something in the present. So for me, one of the big triggers for me is having my sleep disturbed.
Really?
Yeah. And like I've had experiences sort of on a most mundane thing, like my wife disturbs my sleep in small ways, I can end up wide awake, unable to get sleep, having suicidal thoughts or thinking I've got to leave the marriage, I've got to, you know, just totally overblown, out of proportion thoughts over this really small thing, having my sleep disturbed. On the other hand, I've had my sleep disturbed in ways that are much more dramatic, and like one friend once just came into the room where I was sleeping on the couch and he opened the door really violently. I have no idea why he did this, but basically I was woken up. It was a shocking awakening.
Right.
You know? And it really was like traumatic. Like I don't use that word for things in the present, because generally I think most of our traumas are in the past, and, you know, mostly we cope with stuff pretty well as adults. So certainly I would never imagine that somebody opening the door when I was asleep could be traumatic, but I really experienced it that way. It was just like I woke with this feeling of horror.
Right.
And I was really deeply disturbed for a long time after that. It took me quite a while to forgive this friend. I mean, not as in days, but really I just thought he'd done like this worst thing. It's like he'd come into the room and, you know, I could actually come up with some parallels that probably do correspond, you know, with why it was so traumatic. And I wasn't necessarily going here, but I might as well now, which is, okay, so that's a very clear example of something happening in the present that may correspond with something in the past, as in being rudely awoken.
Well, if that seems to be, from what I gathered from that, it seemed like that is a pattern for you.
Yeah.
Where you're asleep and something out of the ordinary, let's say, could happen, and it triggers an emotional event at a high level. I think, you know, the story relating to your friend, I think anybody would be shocked or frightened or mildly traumatized if somebody opens the door violently when they're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
I think anybody is going to have a certain reaction to that, but it could have went to a high level with you because, and this term has been so overused, but for us, I'm fine with it, but you know, there could be something very triggering for you when you're sleeping.
Yeah. And even with the door opening, I mean, possibly. It's an obvious correlation with sexual abuse and being woken up in the night. I mean, those dots just join like that. Right. And it's not like I haven't thought about this before, so I'm just lingering on it because it's obviously, I mean, I brought up the most apropos example of what we were talking about previously, which is emotions that get triggered by a seemingly small thing because of corresponding with something in the past that wasn't small.
Right, right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that insofar as those emotions that get triggered lead to action, you could say that's like a personality. Like, you know, that's what novelists say. Character is narrative. Character is plot. Because what drives the plot, if not the characters, right? So then if we get triggered into a certain emotion that dictates certain action, as in my case, suicide or fleeing, you know, the country or whatever, then that's like a character. That's the character who runs or suicides or kills, or, you know, and he's fueled by a specific emotion, despair, rage, you know, and so on.
Is it a character?
Well, I'm saying I don't experience it as a character in the way that these multiples do that we think of. They got names and all the rest of it. But right. But how is it different except insofar, you know, like how do we... It seems to me that that's a spectrum where it all bleeds together, that we've superimposed these arbitrary distinctions between emotion, action, character. Well, where does one end and the other begin?
Right, because it seems like all those things you mentioned are the ingredients for a personality.
Yeah, an experience of oneself, really.
Right, yeah. So that person, be careful with what I'm saying, for a reason, because how you are when you're woken up and disturbed in your sleep, that may not necessarily be a character, but that just might be you. That might be a major part of you that was not allowed to be experienced.
Right. So it got compartmentalized. It got shut away.
Yes.
And that's what makes it a personality. Is that compartmentalization.
Right. It becomes separate from you. I'm just coming up with a theory here, but it's like it's a part of you that you have had problems having access to.
So, but we have problems having access to it because it got compartmentalized. So actually what it is it's an emotion that it wasn't safe to express or feel, therefore had to get compartmentalized.
Right. It's a part of you, a part of a combination of things, emotions, action, response, that all got compartmentalized because it would have been bad for the people that were hurting you.
Yeah.
That were hurting you.
Yeah, and therefore bad for you. It wasn't safe. Anyway,
in your mind at that time,
you had
survived, and maybe you were coerced, or maybe you were conditioned, or maybe I was conditioned that part of you was bad, and if I expressed it, bad things were going to happen.
Yeah. I think what we're touching on here is quite radical in that is pointing towards how what we think of as personality relates to the suppression and the disowning and the compartmentalization of emotions.
Yes. Yeah, that is a huge ingredient.
So then, because you can look at the parts that you've compartmentalized, shut away, that you don't have access to, and say, well, those are actually, I mean, you phrased that as who you really are, but of course I think what we'd really be talking about is a whole bunch of compartments that all need to be integrated.
Yes.
All different parts, and until they're all integrated, we won't have access to what we are. But in the meantime, if the more we see that we have these compartmentalized emotions that weren't safe to experience or express, The more we have to see that the self that we experience as ourselves is itself a compartment that was deemed safe. Like these are the emotions and these are the modes that have been designated safe. We're going to compartmentalize these. All the rest gets shut away. This is the one compartment that you have access to. This is your mailbox, right? All incoming mail comes to this identity, and all outgoing mail comes from this identity. Therefore, this is who I am.
This compartment, right? This compartmentalized mailbox that you're talking about is the one that's safe, the one that's acceptable,
yeah.
The one that the only ones that we're allowed to operate from.
Yeah.
Right, right, and that makes a ton of sense to me. And again, it goes back to coming to the table with the piece of clay and getting the fine chisels out and making it what it is, you know.
Well, because, I mean, we're talking about uncovering the past and the trauma and becoming whole. Well, let's just say we're talking about something we don't really have a frame of reference for in our language or in our society.
Okay.
So, one of the language subsets we have for it is spirituality.
Okay.
And, well, I don't know where I'm going with this exactly. I mean, you and I, we don't do spiritual talk. I don't generally do it. And this is largely why, because I think it's been co-opted.
Well, I think you're showing common sense in being careful about going into spirituality. I think it makes sense that you were wary of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, because you're Catholic, so you, so I would be particularly, I don't know about particularly wary, but I would be aware that your spirituality is going to be very different from my spirituality.
Well, I'm not Catholic anymore. I'm an Orthodox Christian, which is actually very different in a lot of ways.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So obviously not the same, but same ballpark, Orthodox Christian.
There is some same ballpark, but I think you said the magic phrase there, you know, that it has been co-opted and it deserves its own amount of attention. And I think sometimes it's hard to balance out talking spirituality with what we're talking about right now. But that's just my opinion.
Right. So what I'm saying, I think that is that what we're talking about right now is spirituality.
Okay. Yeah.
Because we're talking about the self, like the true self.
Yeah.
Now, for a Christian, that's your immortal soul.
Right.
That's the thing that gets to go to heaven or hell. I don't know if you're that Orthodox or how you are on heaven and hell, but it's pretty fundamental to Christianity.
Right. And no, touche on that one, because we are talking about spirituality. That's mm-hmm. very true. But it also, it's a hard conversation because it has been so long.
Absolutely.
And in Christianity, you know.
Yeah, all of it.
How much of what we're given as Christianity right now is real and what's not?
Well, to push back to that point I made about therapists and about being fed narratives that may be true, but that prevent us from discovering the truth ourselves.
Right.
And that's how I feel about Christianity. I think it's basically true, not the part about hell, although actually even hell I think exists, but I think it's man-made. I think the devil is man-made. I think there's just God and us, and even there I'd say it's probably just us, but God is, you know, we are God. But anyway, don't get me, I don't want to go too far down that road. My point was is that I think most of the tenets of Christianity are true, but the fact they've been assembled into a narrative that gets fed to us means that it prevents us from discovering that the truth for ourselves. So it becomes untrue.
Because there's a lot of compartmentalization in that.
And moral judgment, and I mean, fragmented people can only create fragmented narratives. Jesus didn't write the Bible.
That's right.
And God sure as hell didn't.
No. And it was written by people.
Yeah.
You know, that's like a lot of really good Bible scholars will tell you that. You know, there was a Bible scholar that said, you know, he gets upset sometimes with other Christians because they say that they're against like channeling and it's sinful and automatic writing, how the hand does, you know, I don't even know what I'm writing right now. My hand is just moving across the page. But yet when they talk about the Bible being written, they treat it as if it was that.
Yeah. It's received, delivered. It's
written by authors of their time.
Yeah.
You know, thousands of years ago, living in influenced by Mesopotamia and the Assyrians, there was all kinds of stuff.
And edited by political committees, and then, of course, mm-hmm. translated. And so, yeah, we're getting a very watered-down version. Mm-hmm. So the Christian, it's a leap of faith, of course, Christianity, and one of the big leaps is, yeah, that somehow God managed to get the truth to Christians in the form of language, a written, you know, an object that they can find in every hotel room, and there it is. Well, yeah. I mean, it's not impossible. Like God, you know, with God, all things are possible. René Girard was interesting because he, the philosopher, he became a Catholic at the end of his life, and he claimed to believe that the Bible actually was a, how would he have put it, that it contained a key to salvation. I don't know if he'd put it quite that bluntly, but essentially he believed that actually the meanings in the Bible are powerful to dispel illusion and to bring about, particularly the gospel. Well, he talked about it as how we live in this mythological construct, which is all about sacrifice and scapegoating, and the Bible offers the solution to actually, because it's a myth that actually exposes the machinery of myths, because Christ volunteered to be sacrificed and he was innocent, whereas all the myths previously, they present the sacrifice victim as guilty, and that's how they maintain social order, is that mm-hmm. they constantly scapegoat the anomalous figure, and then we all agree that he's guilty, and then we turn him into a god afterwards, but essentially it's never revealed that he was an innocent victim, and the Bible revealed that, and by doing so it offered the means to actually transcend our cultural matrix. I guess it's in the Bible in terms of turning the other cheek. Somebody comes at you with violence. Instead of reacting, you just embrace the violence. You know, you don't add violence to violence, and that basic principle allows the violence and the abuse, the cycles of abuse, to end, because they got no traction.
Right, because as you say, you choose not to become a poison container.
We can't choose not to become a container, because that's done to you. You choose not to offload your poisons on anybody else.
Right.
Which means you've just got to sit in the poisons as long as it takes.
Right.
By definition, the thing that no one wants to do. And like the turning the other cheek is a thing that we can experience on a daily basis. I know I do, which is you get triggered and you want to react. Well, not that you want to react, you do react, you have to react in a defensive way, and the possibility of actually just letting go of the thing that has triggered us in the moment of being triggered is almost impossible. It's so close to impossible, because all of our mental and emotional, everything's telling us you must react, you must defend who you are that is currently under attack.
Right.
And what the story of Jesus is about, I think, or Gerard said, I would agree, was inhibiting that kind of reptilian defense system.
And transforming that part of it, right.
Yeah. Which is the Satan identity, actually. Interesting, it's the thing, you know, the altar that Satan that protects us. I think Gerard would probably go along with that in some way.
Right. That reptilian part of us, is, like you said, is the actual thing that people consider the Satan, you know. And that's very true.
Yeah, because it's in us naturally. That was part of the organism, the reptilian brain, fight or flight. We need it to survive as organisms, but the abuse brings it all the way to the center. It stimulates it so relentlessly that it just takes over consciousness completely, and we just get locked into a reptilian fight or flight response, defense system.
Right. I mean, and that's where you can easily get stuck. That's what I think is what is it. It almost to me brings us back to, you know, where we were going before about emotions, about, you know, not being compartmentalized,
mm-hmm.
you know, learning how to bring everything into a whole.
Yeah.
It's like if you have moral concerns, you can't compartmentalize the reptilian part. You would have to accept it for what it is and bring it better knowledge, you know, to say, you know, you don't have to be in this reactionary place all the time. You know, that reptilian part of us will be with us until, you know, whenever it is we die, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's I think it's like rage, for example, like there are certain emotions that, because of their function is to defend against violence or threat, they're more insistent, or they're louder. You know, they have to big themselves up, like certain animals that puff themselves up to look bigger than they are. So there's parts of us that, when they're activated, their function is to overwhelm us. So like fright, if you have to run, you need to be flooded with adrenaline, you need to... Terror is the means by which we escape, right? It could paralyze us, of course, but even the paralysis is an attempt to not get killed, right? Maybe they won't see us if we stop moving. And then rage is fight. Again, you've got to be so possessed by rage that you'll just go berserker like Wolverine, you know, just tearing, no matter how much bigger he is, you're just fucking tearing. So that, yeah, that's, I think that's what we're looking at. Like when those things get overstimulated, they overwhelm, and then all the other feelings, the subtler feelings, just get drowned out.
Yeah, and that's the way it's supposed to, you know, it's like when you have an adrenaline dump, you experience auditory exclusion, you know, it's the same idea. And yet, you can experience auditory exclusion.
Say more about that, because I'm not familiar with this adrenaline dump experience. I mean, probably am actually with the experience, but I'm not familiar with the science of it.
Yeah, there are times where you can, if you have, you know, if you get into a traumatic situation or like a car, let's say you get into a car accident, and like when it happens, when the impact happens, your body has an adrenaline dump. You have an adrenaline rush, and you might experience auditory exclusion, or things might, the way you see things might become very, very clear. You know, your body becomes so, foot and mind becomes so focused on what's going on at that moment.
Right.
It's just a natural thing that happens to human beings, you know, and it's just a part of who we are.
So it's correlating then, obviously, the emotions with the chemicals, and I think, you know, when we're talking about organized abuse and dissociative identity disorder, like, how does that work? You know, this is always the, it's this ongoing mystery. And I mean, maybe a big part of it is understanding chemistry. As in, you do this to an organism, these chemicals are released, they're going to go to these, you know what I mean? I'm like,
yeah. I'm to the point where, in my own experience, I believe that whoever the people were who did what they did to this family that I was abused by, and in turn they did it to me, they knew what they were doing. And that's my belief at this time. If somebody with the evidence came to me and said it wasn't that way and they had the proof of it, I would have to change. You know, I would have to change my mind. But to me personally, in one man's opinion, they must have had a knowledge of how the human body reacts, how the mind reacts, and they must have had a general knowledge of knowing how to manipulate it to our disadvantage. Because for the things that they did to work, they would have to keep, either they would have to kill the person that they were abusing or keep that person so incredibly off balance that they would not be able to think every day. Because they kept me alive. And if they did not keep me off balance, if they did not keep me, if they did not stop me from trusting myself, then their secret would have been out.
Right. So, I mean, you keep coming back to that, but it leaves unanswered, like, why they were doing it in the first place. They're doing things to you, and they're going to compartmentalize you and fragment you so that you can't resist and you can't remember, or you can't tell on them and all the rest of it. So that's in order to carry on doing what they're doing, they need that. But what is it that they're doing?
Well, it's a good question, and that seems to be the question that everybody debates about and everybody argues about, and people like us are very unsure about. Because we know that we've experienced something and we've made it our journey in life to figure out what happened to us.
And why.
And why. And obviously it went beyond, you know, a sexual act, even though the sexual act was a very, very important part of what happened to us. It was as if these people wanted full dominance of a child from his physically, mentally, and spiritually. Could it be their religion? Could it be their addiction to... Somebody called me. Sorry about that. Could it be an addiction to forbidden sex that they didn't want anybody to know about? And within that personal addiction, that they were making money from filming it and showing it to other people that had an addiction to forbidden sex? Were we an experiment? Was it a spiritual act for them? Was it a combination of those things?
Lay aside the arm, lay aside the ancient, lay aside the night, lay aside completion, lay aside the course, lay toward me, and lay in the light, and lay aside the hour, just lay aside the hunger, and lay upon me, and lay like before, and lay aside the return, and lay aside eternity. Just lay aside the hour, lay aside the lay aside the lay. The range of every day, not being alone, the lay of the sun ray, wandering round home. Dimensions of the day, real spool of time, events in space traced along a line. Just lay aside the hour, just lay aside the ancient, lay aside the night, lay aside completion, lay aside the course, lay toward me, and lay in the light, and lay aside the hour, just lay aside the hunger, and lay upon me, and lay like before, and lay aside the return, and lay aside eternity, just lay aside the hour, just lay aside the lay, where me and boredom, and me and the 20th century, me and an entity, and me and my identity, and me and winter, and me and nothing, and me and feeling, and me and something, and me and the perambulation, and me and the navigation, and me and the lotus, and me and boredom. And I sing the words, what other words can I sing? The words of love and not just anything. Oh, the way of my lay, this lay of my say, the way of my lay, the lay of my say. And time ain't what it used to be, the feelings past, strands of memories cast, and time ain't what it used to be. I know it don't last, time minutes to the mast, and time ain't what it used to be. The clock of serendipity, what does it do to me? Time ain't what it used to be. Hey, genealogy, hey, you history, I know it don't last, I know it don't last, I know it don't last, I know it don't last. Just lay aside the hour, lay aside the ancient, lay aside the night, just lay aside completion, lay aside the course, lay toward me, and lay in the light, and lay aside the hour, just lay aside the hunger, and lay upon me, just lay like before, and lay aside the return, lay aside eternity, lay aside the hour, just lay aside the lay, lay aside stupidity. No, you have none, for this life gives force, for this life gives force, for this life gives force.
Yeah, we'll definitely go with combination. Even if we allow that this is, compulsive sexual addiction and whatnot that's really driving these people, and that they just come up with incredibly elaborate rationalizations, it's still worthwhile figuring out what those rationalizations are, because there's clues in them, right?
Right.
And also clues to, how they proceed and the methods and all the rest of it. So, I was going to say something else. What was it? Oh, I know. I think probably the best way that I've come up with to try and figure out is by looking at what the results are.
Okay.
As in, you know, whatever was done to you, what was done to me, if it was more than just, sexual compulsion and just, you know, finding anyone they could find that was convenient, and if there was actually an attempt to, if there was a longer term goal involved, then we ourselves would be evidence, even if we're evidence of the failure of that, of those goals, right? Yeah. In my case, I had my brother to look at, and it was looking at my brother that really alerted me to the possibility that my family was involved in all this, like what he became, you know, in the context of finding out more and more about celebrity culture and, you know, the influence of culture and how cultural figures seem to be so often implicated in these kind of organized abuse programs and so on and so forth, then in that context, or what about my brother? He was a small-time celebrity, but still he had all these symptoms and so on and so forth. So I can look at my brother and say, well, maybe, just maybe, my brother was more or less what they were aiming to create, although even he, maybe it wasn't successful, maybe he had to be taken out, or he self-destructed, or maybe that was all part of, you know, the foreseen end goal, I don't know. But anyway, he was definitely more successful of such a hypothetical program than I was. So then I can see the ways in which the programming didn't take with me, and the ways in which it did, by comparing myself to my brother and constantly examining, you know, what I'm doing, kind of on a regular basis, like how much have I been turned into something that might be useful? It might have been intentional and might be useful. So do you have these thoughts or concerns about yourself, or questions about whether you're actually being, whether there was an attempt to turn you into something?
I think you've addressed this before, and I never really, I think I was too focused on how I was so confused about everything and so much in emotional turmoil that I never really gave myself a chance to validate it that much. You know, I mean, because once you do that, once you say to yourself, was I part of, you know, what was I supposed to be used for? What was I being turned into something for me? That would have been a validation that something happened to me. And that's been a struggle my whole life, is not believing that something happened to me.
Yeah, but same here. I mean, even more so in my case. So it doesn't mean you can't look back now. And
well, that's what I'm doing, because you threw out that bone, and I said, wait a minute, this, you know, this guy could be right. You know, and now I've gotten much more comfortable with thinking that way. And so the level that I've taken it to, I believe that I was at a place with people that were probably not as refined as some of these organized abuse people are. And I think I was just used as cattle. I don't know if I was being turned into something per se. There might have been an opportunity for that, but basically, there's a good chance that I might be on film somewhere, or my cousin might be on film, and that might be about it. But I will say, if they could have worked on me a little bit more, maybe that family might have had another body that they could have used to do the nefarious things that they did. I wouldn't be surprised at all about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, presumably that's, I shouldn't say presumably, but I mean, if it's organized, it's got to find ways to perpetuate, expand, and extend its reach and all the rest of it, and that includes recruiting or creating new drones.
Right.
Didn't you say that you were in law enforcement?
Me? No, I'm not.
Well, I mean, I know you're kind of security guard now or something like that, but you mentioned something before that.
No, I was never a law enforcement officer.
No, it's probably my wife who said, oh, he seems a bit like a cop. But there's something that, I mean, I don't want to, because there might be things you don't want to go on record, but you can always just say that off the record. But because you mentioned that your current work allows you to carry a gun, so I figured I was probably night security or something like that.
I'm a security officer.
Security officer. But I thought, and it's in the pictures, but I thought you said there was something you did before.
Oh, I was.
I don't know.
I was a bail bondsman for a while.
What's that? What's he do?
A bail bondsman goes, like, if somebody gets arrested and you know, they need to bond out of jail. Like, let's say you get arrested for drunk driving. And they say, well, you could either do your time or, you know, the county or the state says you can do your time, the 30 days or whatever, or you can bond out and come back for your trial. So your bond would be roughly like $2,000, and a bail bondsman covers that bond for you, and you pay the bail bondsman $200, 10%, to act as insurance that you come back to jail, or you come back to your court date.
Right, so but that doesn't entail chasing them down if they skip bail, or does it?
It does, yeah.
It does, so you've got to be that guy too.
You've got to be the bounty hunter and the bail bond.
You got to be the what?
You got to be the bounty hunter and the bail bond.
Right, bounty hunter, exactly.
Yes, that is the bounty.
Right. So, yeah, not a million miles away then. I mean, I don't know if you had experiences of that. Did you have when you had to actually chase people down?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So you would have been an asset, is what it sounds like. If they could have turned you into a grunt for their operations, you'd have been quite an asset.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, even before that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised that they were not trying to groom me for certain things, because it makes sense. Number one, you know, if you compare it to what they did possibly with your brother, you know, or possibly with you, I mean, that opens up a whole new world for me. If they could get you to think about the same sexual things, or a thirst for money, or a thirst to do violence to people,
mm-hmm.
I think that would have been fairly easy for me as a kid, you know, to be able to be pushed in that direction.
Right. Yeah, you could have been like Leonard Cohen, you know, like a assassin music industry guy, like, you know, two for the price of one.
Leonard Cohen is a bat. Oh my God.
Well, that's what Anne Diamond thinks. I mean, there's not much evidence for him being an assassin, but there's quite a bit of circumstantial evidence that he was a spook.
Right. I remember listening to that podcast. Yeah, I mean, that's funny, because that does jog memories, because this kid was always trying to get us over to his side of things. You know, he really, really wanted, it was like they were just standing around waiting for us to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of prodding in that direction. So, but I also believe that I was working, or they were working in a much cruder level than maybe something that your brother was experiencing.
Yeah, well, I mean, every time you say that, I have to feel like I have to qualify, because it's like charred earth, you know. You see the charred earth, you know something hit it, but mm-hmm. What? Like, was it a UFO, or was it, you know, just a bomber, or was it? There's so many different possibilities. But anyway, without going into there, have you read Seen or Not Seen?
Was that a book you wrote?
Yeah.
No, I have not read.
I'll tell you why I asked, because it's something you just said about if they could get you to have violent thoughts or violent desires, and you didn't put it in those words, but it was pretty close to that. And so that that then brought my attention to the fact that what we were talking about previous to that is at a very coarse literal level, as in, can they turn us into, you know, foot soldiers for their evil regime, for the Dark Empire, stormtroopers for the Dark Empire kind of question. Well, or you know, cultural figures, in the case of me and my brother.
Right.
But actually, the most subtler, the more subtle question, and one that's much easier to look for evidence of, is to what extent did they successfully install certain values, desires, proclivities within us? Now, so I brought up Seen and Not Seen because that book is about the way that my identity was shaped through culture, pop culture, movies and stuff. And at a certain point, I veer into the deeper, darker stuff, which is my predilection as an adolescent for rape imagery, of women being raped, women being murdered, women being even tortured, and how I would watch this footage. I mean, just not snuff, thank God. It was pre-internet, just video nasties and horror movies that I would find in the video store, and then sometimes they would have a scene that I found arousing, and then I'd copy it, pirate it onto tape. So I had this tape that had all these different clips from these different horror movies and whatnot, with all this imagery on it. And that was at a very young age. It was like 13. So, and one of the ways that I justified it or rationalized it to myself was, well, I would never act on this. This is just a fantasy. This is just, you know, it's not real. I didn't know why I was turned on by it, but
right.
I figured it was harmless because I was naive. I didn't understand that, you know, that I was doing something to myself.
Right.
Never mind that I wasn't going out and actually hurting anyone else, that I was hurting myself with this stuff. So yeah, and that was definitely, once I was mature enough to start looking at that and saying, well, wait a minute, it wasn't just that I was freaky and anomalous and weird, there's some reason that I was drawn to that imagery, and then start looking for the reasons, and then that led me to my brother, who was more openly depraved,
right,
and then to the trauma, and then to the organized abuse. So actually, in fact, the very thing that you mentioned there was, in retrospect, that was my first clue that I had unhealthy desires and proclivities and sexual responses in myself that I never understood. And in retrospect, they were put there.
Right. I wouldn't doubt it because I know, like, when I was a kid, you know, I would watch a lot of violent movies that had like a cathartic climax to it, you know, like The Wild Bunch. You know, I watch that a lot. Like, I always look forward to that last gunfight where they finally all got to just, you know, lay it all out there. I don't know how much of that I was in touch with it being sexual. There might have been an element to that, but like, I remember that, or I remember, I used to love that movie Thief by Michael Mann. I don't know if you saw that movie, James Bond.
Yeah.
Just the you know, it was a great movie because there's a lot of cultural things that I could relate to. But the end where he finally just lays it all out and takes down all the people that have been fucking with him for so long, you know, it was a really pleasing to watch, you know. So there might be some relation there. But the one thing I did when I was a kid around that age was I watched a lot of porn, a lot of VHS porn. Mm-hmm. And that was always around in that atmosphere. You know, this family had tons of pornography in their house, whether it was magazines, like VHS tapes. So I watched a lot of porn, but I could only really watch what was easy for me to accept. You know, like I could only watch like real, I don't know, is there anything as normal porn? I don't know, but it was usually like, I could watch, you know, a guy sleeping with a woman or two women sleeping together, and I would
probably not much sleeping going on though,
or fucking, whatever you want to. You know, it's like, you know, that's. But I watched a lot of it, and it got to the point where, like, it has been years since I've actually watched any porn because I don't want to do it anymore. It gives me the worst feeling that you can, you know, just like this really, really nasty feeling to watch it. Now, I mean, am I going to say that somebody else isn't going to have a pleasant experience? Maybe, but it's just for me, I can't do it. I just can't.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's less relevant, I think, than what it is that creates a desire to watch porn in the first place, besides it being available. Now, I could have blamed my predilection for rape scenes on the video nasty culture. I mean, they were eroticized, no doubt about it. Half those movies had big-breasted women on the verge of being raped on the cover, you know? It's not as though I'd pulled it out of my own psyche. It was in the culture too, that, and it's not even subtle, but it's subtle enough that even today, to talk about it is verboten. Like, I've had practice now. I've written the book, I've done the podcast. I've had enough practice that I can now talk about something that essentially I've been ashamed of for decades. Like, I was ashamed of it at the time, and I was ashamed for decades after, because no one was talking about it, and because it wasn't acknowledged that we do live in a porn culture and a rape culture and an abuse culture and so on, you know, basically everything that is harmful to the human psyche is in one corner or another is being marketed and exploited and therefore glamorized and glorified. Sure. But it's in plain sight.
Yes. You know? Yeah, absolutely. But going back to what you're saying, though, what I was saying was is that this family had stores of pornography laying around, and it was and it was pushed upon us. I mean, I'm not mincing my words at all. There was a reason for that.
Right.
You know, there was always a pressure to watch pornography when you were around those people. But it was never outright said, you're going to sit here and watch pornography. They never did anything like that. It was all innuendo. It was all manipulation. It was all coercion. It was like a parent trying to get their kid to eat their vegetables without smacking them in the face to eat it. It literally was that. So to me, what's the difference? It's like maybe there was somebody who did plant that idea in your head, because I know it was planted in mine. Because it was a grooming process.
Right.
Because if they could get you to keep swallowing this stuff, then they got you. You know, and I understand that we all have some kind of, maybe whether that happened to me or not, there would be some type of, you know, sexual thing that I might have a thought about, you know, but how far I would have taken it, I don't know. But, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, they would leave porn all over the place. And I, you know, this was back at a time where you couldn't just go on the internet. You know, they used to order these big books from the mail that cost a lot of money. They were like these 100-page full color books of pornography. I don't even know how much that would have cost back then.
Mm-hmm. And what's the earliest incident you remember of being exposed to pornography?
I was exposed to pornography at like 9 years old, maybe earlier, like between like 8.5, 9 years old. And when we were kids, you know, we had these little patches of woods around the house, around the houses in the area. And there would, for some miraculous reason, there was always somebody leaving like stacks of them all over the place. They would just be left there. And they were tied up. Like, you know how people stack newspapers where they tie up newspaper and just drop it on the corner? That's what they would do with Hustler magazine, pornography magazines, Playboy, Hustler. And they would just be left in the woods at different locations. So it's like, okay, did you want kids to find this or something?
So That's very interesting. I mean, I got a memory of being at the boarding school, Abbotsome, that I went to for a couple of terms, and of porn magazines in the forest, and I don't remember. I remember, there was some secret stash there, but I don't remember whose it was or how I knew about it. But it's quite a close thing.
Yeah.
Porn magazine in the forest.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like... And it wasn't like, I know if I was a kid, I wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, but if I stole, we all had that story back in the day about, you know, some 13-year-old kid stealing his uncle's Penthouse magazine, you know,
yeah.
And, but it wasn't like that. It was, you know, if I was, I would have hit it. I would have like dug a hole. Like these things were left in stacks somewhere on in the woods where you could easily find it. And if it happened once, it's one thing, but when it happens four or five times, what the hell's going on?
Yeah. Well, because you know, you mentioned it had no internet back then, so. But now, like the immersion that you experienced being immersed in a world of porn, that's not overstating it, being kind of surrounded by it from an early age. Yep. With the internet, that's now become the normal culture environment
right.
for kids. I mean, they don't have to go to the porn, but on the other hand, if they go anywhere, you know, off the beaten trail at all on the internet, they're going to end up with flashing porn ads, links to click, and... next thing you know, they're in the deep end of it. So,
right,
it does seem as though that culture has been engineered for us.
Yeah, it's been. I think there is a level of normalization that has occurred. Whereas back when I was a kid, it was not as nearly as rampant, you know, but. Again, I go back to my personal experience of where, you know, this was done by design to me and to my family members that were there. They use the word of grooming, and that's there's a reason why they use that word. So going back to what happened to you, you know, you wrote this book, Seen and Not Seen, and then just a while ago you told me stories about when your sleep is interrupted in a certain way, you have very strong reactions to it. I mean, that just didn't come out of the air.
Yeah, I also had night terrors, is what it's called. Like I would wake up in a state of terror with no external trigger at all, some dream.
Yeah, I mean it. You know, you said that you would be awoken from sleep in a certain way, and you would become suicidal and wanting to leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
And is that? I mean, there was no exaggeration in that.
Well, I mean, it depends how you understand it, because like there's a voice in my head, not as in my ear, but. My thing, you know, internal monologue is telling me these things. There's also a part of me that's listening and saying, well, that's bullshit. So is it an exaggeration to say? I mean, depends, you know, like everything, or like many things, how we experience, how much do we believe our feelings and our thoughts, and how much are we just observing them? So what I'm describing to you is me observing those. I'm not actually... rationally thinking, oh, I need to kill myself now or I'm going to leave the country. I'm just like, whoa. So, you know, I mean, it's a very weird and interesting question, isn't it? How emotions get turned into thoughts.
Right.
But on the other hand, how thoughts sort of, how they give rise to emotions. So if we have certain thoughts, we can stim ourselves into having certain feelings, and then those feelings themselves get translated into thoughts. It's a spectrum. But what it begins from is a more of a visceral response, reaction, you know, more of an affect, a bodily feeling of distress.
Yeah, and I guess that's the point that I'm getting at, is that just to use you as an example of how you can be in a deep sleep and you're next to your wife, who I would suppose you trust, and to wake up like that, you know, to me, there seems to be that, again, I'm going back to, there's a part of you that may have been lying dormant. And so how does that relate to years ago when you were exposing yourself to these movies and experiencing an arousal from it, from something you considered to be abhorrent? You know, where do those things correlate? And to me, that sounds like a person that is traumatized to a certain extent. You know, the same, you know, the same as me, is when I realized, like, I was watching pornography and I wasn't really enjoying that much. It was more like just trying to pull a slot machine. You know, it was like, I'll go buy this porn, rent this porn video and see if I can experience that rise, that arousal, and then I feel like shit.
Yeah, well, I think we maybe bring it full circle, because we're talking about being disconnected from the larger portion of who we are, and making the correlation between that and our bodies, our organic selves. If we're left with a fragment of who we are that is really cut off from our physical being and our, you know, our deeper spiritual being, that fragment is going to be hungry for some sort of intense physical sensation, experience of itself, feeling alive, and voila, porn.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't used porn since, the last period where I still dabbled a little bit was 10 years ago or something, when I was 40. And I became, you know, very aware of that, how it was, what made it addictive was just it really, the rush of actually being present and being in my body and just feeling like I was really here and really alive.
Right.
In this unfortunate context of something that I, you know, considered abhorrent, as you put it.
Yeah, and see, the thing is, though, good for you for saying that, because you brought it to a place where I probably was struggling to find the right words, is you get that rush feeling where you said you feel like you're alive. So to me, trying to make these, you know, trying to find this correlation, what was it that deadened us so much that we would have to do this? And I know it probably happens to a lot of people. I don't want to dispute that. I'm just saying that for us specifically, were we deadened because we could not respond to those traumatic things that happened to us, because that was the only way we could be, or we were taught?
It's dead, yeah, of course. It's just, and that's the safest thing to be as well, is dead. You're not a threat.
So possibly it could be the safest thing to be, but could that have been done to us on purpose?
Also, if you deaden somebody by filling them with poisons, all the things that we're talking about, you know that they are going to desperately want something that makes them feel alive, because they're not actually dead. They're conscious of being unconscious, kind of thing. You know, we're aware of being cut off from something, and we're going to try and do anything we can to feel alive again. And then you provide, you know, create the demand and then create the supply. Then you provide outlets or, you know, recourses
right.
that will provide the easiest solution for that.
Right.
So that, I mean, that's like a really simple principle, but you can see how if that was applied on sort of, on a large scale, we've got these dead souls, they're going to do anything they can to feel alive. Now we're going to create the channels that they will naturally be drawn to because they'll get that feeling. They will turn themselves into porn addicts, they'll turn themselves into rapists, they'll turn themselves into killers, right. whatever we want them to be.
They will only, we created the symptoms and the disease, and we will provide the cure that they yeah. that they need.
The medication, yeah, the anesthetic.
Cure, I'm sorry, not the cure, you're right, the medication so they can just keep staying on this hamster wheel.
Yeah.
And I guess my point is, once again, going back to the reasons why they did it, and that's why I keep going back to saying that they have to create this person who's not going to talk, who's not going to respond. Okay, so I've said that numerous times already. But my point is there's a reason why they're doing that. So, you know, when it comes to your brother or you or what happened to me, at whatever level, at whatever skill level that they did it at, why did they do it? And in my novice mind, I almost feel like maybe this was almost a religion for them.
Mm-hmm.
And religions need money. And people also create religions so they can produce something. And sometimes I believe that these people got some kind of essence from them, or that's mm-hmm. what they were after. And I'm going into pretty strange territory. I'm fully aware of that. But I almost feel like they wanted to get something intangible from us. And they were very thorough and effective at doing that. They're like, we're going to use the whole animal. You know, we want to get this essence from us, from these children or whatever, but we're also going to use them to make money, and we're also going to use them to pleasure ourselves. Because there's a lot of money in abusing children. But at the same time, they're so good at what they do, they were able to satisfy some personal urge or almost a spiritual journey in hurting us.
Hmm.
And that's really what I believe now. Again, I could be proven totally wrong, but as of this time, that's what I believe.
Isn't that fairly close to Christian view of the devil, as in the harvesting of souls?
I guess you could equate it to that. I mean, it could be.
I guess the devil wants our essence.
Right, right.
And offers immortality in exchange for it.
Right, but along with that essence, they also get a lot of worldly compensation.
Mm-hmm. The perks as a job.
Yeah, or you know, I can't imagine how much money, you know, the family who did what they did to me made off of me or off of my cousin. You know, I'd love to know.
So you're going to carry on seeing the therapist then?
Yeah, I'm going to keep going and see how it turns out.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, it sounds like it's what you need.
Yeah, it's doing me a lot of good. I hope she's not an agent of the dark side, you know. I'm a sucker.
Well, yeah, I need to trust your instincts and up to a certain point without, you know, shutting down your skeptical faculties, obviously. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't benefit, even if somebody did have a an agenda, there's still ways to benefit from.
Right. And that's kind of how I thought about, you know, like that whole discussion about Colin Ross. It's like he may be, you know, somebody who would be considered untrustworthy, but he did put out a lot of good information.
I know. And of course, that, not to start another conversation, but then that. Yeah, no, I won't even. But yeah, I agree. I mean, a person can have all kinds of good motivations and end up doing horrible things. So why not the other way around?
Right, right, right.